Good evening. This is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Among the most intriguing and enigmatic figures of the past century was German pastor, theologian, and author Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Born in 1906, Bonhoeffer was hanged by the Nazis when he was 39, just a month before the war in Europe ended. His work and life were celebrated this past week in a remarkable symposium at Boston University entitled Faith and Resistance, the Struggle of a German Theologian Against the Nazi Terror. The symposium looked at Bonhoeffer from four perspectives: history, politics, theology, and education. Living at ground zero of the Holocaust, Dietrich Bonhoeffer confronted the evils of the Third Reich from its very first days. Throughout his adult life, he courageously opposed what he saw as the godless face of Nazism. This theological and political resistance, together with his condemnation of anti-Semitism, cost him his life and moved his contemporaries to call him a modern Christian martyr. Already something of an international figure in his early 30s, Bonhoeffer joined German military intelligence in 1940, ostensibly to use his contacts to advance the Third Reich. In fact, he used the position to inform the outside world of the German resistance, of which he was a member, and to try to gain support for that resistance. That effort failed. Bonhoeffer then worked to help Jews escape from Germany and finally came to support direct action against Adolf Hitler. He was arrested in 1943 and for 2 years was moved from prison to prison. At Flossenbürg concentration camp, less than a month before Germany surrendered to the Allies, Bonhoeffer was hanged, together with other conspirators against the supreme leader, Adolf Hitler. The Bonhoeffer Symposium at Boston University featured two panels. The first concerned the spheres of politics and history. The second concerned the theological and educational Bonhoeffer. Tonight, we present excerpts from the first panel, made up of four distinguished speakers, including Boston University Chancellor Dr. John Silber, Jeffrey Hill, University Professor of Literature and Religion, Professor of History Dietrich Orloff of the College of Arts and Sciences, and Ambassador and Minister Charles Stith. The moderator of the panel was Boston journalist Christopher Lydon. Next week, we will present excerpts from the second panel. We begin tonight with the opening of the symposium, a welcome by Boston University President John Westling.
I will have no right to participate in the reconstruction of Christian life in Germany after the war if I do not share the trials of this time with my people. So wrote Dietrich Bonhoeffer to Reinhold Niebuhr on the eve of his departure from New York to return to Germany in 1939. As it happened, of course, Pastor Bonhoeffer fully earned his right to participate in the reconstruction of Germany, but it was a right he did not live to exercise. On April 9, 1945, he was hanged at Flossenbürg. But, of course, in another sense, Pastor Bonhoeffer did live to exercise his right, not only to reconstruct Germany after Nazism, but to become one of the most important, difficult, and challenging figures in modern Christianity. And today's symposium offers an opportunity to reflect on and to discuss those challenges of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's life and thought. Bonhoeffer challenges us by his insistence on the unity of the church and the world, a surprising insistence for a Lutheran. It is not the pallid unity of a church accommodating itself to all things secular and remade to the themes of political liberation. That would be no challenge at all. Rather, he understood the mission of the church to extend into the institutions that comprise the modern world, into the family, into the workplace, and into the state. Pastor Bonhoeffer is among the few great heroes of conscience of the 20th century. His views put him early and inexorably on a path of opposition to Nazi totalitarianism. But I think he is today better known for what he did than for why he did it. Pastor Bonhoeffer denounced the Nuremberg laws. He worked to save the German Jews. He smuggled Jews out of Germany. But he did so not for humanitarian reasons as these are conventionally understood. Rather, he acted first as a man of faith, believing that no one could be excluded from the possibility of finding life in Christ. Thus, in secular terms, he can seem a mysterious and ambiguous figure. Today's symposium will, I hope, help us to right the balance and to see Bonhoeffer's Christology as clearly as we see his courage, and to understand his ministry as we admire his resistance. A man of faith who also condoned assassination, Bonhoeffer requires rich and nuanced pigments of portraiture if he's to be seen clearly. I want to welcome you all here to Boston University and to this very important symposium, and to express my hope and my confidence that you will find it a moving and intellectually fulfilling event. Thank you for being here.
Following this welcome by Boston University President John Westling, Professor of Worship Horace T. Allen, Jr. spoke. Professor Allen was close to several of Bonhoeffer's lifelong friends.
It has been my privilege as a theological student to have known Paul Lehmann, who was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's closest friend in this country. It was Paul Lehmann who spent the last day with Dietrich on a ship in New York Harbor, trying to dissuade him from returning to Germany. But Paul failed, and as Paul said, "Well, I failed." And secondly, through Paul, I came to know Eberhard and Renata Bethke. Eberhard, of course, being the person to whom the letters were written, largely from Tegel and Prince Albrechtstrasse prison. And Renata, his wife, who was Dietrich's niece. I want just to perhaps suggest a couple of matters that we might bear in mind. The first is the question of the relationship of the church to its culture. This is not a silly question in our own time, even in our own nation. As the question now arises, shall the church be the agency of the government in dealing with the needy, faith-based communities? This is not a silly question, and it is one which perhaps means more to the church than to culture. Also, to bear in mind the crisis which the church found itself in Germany, not because it was Germany, but because of the times between World War I and World War II, in which the Western world suffered, in a sense, a major collapse of its economy, but even more important, of its ethos as Christendom. So that, secondly, to put it another way, using the same words, the church and culture. Bonhoeffer represented culture. That's to say, his family was very well placed, was well connected, and in fact was well supported financially. And the role which such culture played in Germany during this time is very important. And then, thirdly, Dietrich and his decisions. He was a pacifist. And for a pacifist, he was a great disciple of Gandhi. He wanted to go to India to meet Gandhi. For a pacifist to be engaged in an assassination plot is an extraordinary human and mental maneuver, which suggests that there are still some tangles or unknown factors in Bonhoeffer's witness. Indeed, the complexities remain Some years ago, when Eberhard Bethke and Renata were here at the invitation of our university to speak in the Institute of Religion and Philosophy on friendship, Eberhard said at the time that was the first time anyone had asked him to speak about his friendship with Bonhoeffer. When they were here, Eberhard asked me to track down Dietrich's diary of the few weeks he was here in 1939, that is to say, in New York at Union Seminary. I said, well, that will be easy because probably it's in Paul Lehmann's papers, which have been given already to the Princeton Seminary Library. So I called my friend the curator that evening, and he said, I will look. The next morning, he called to say, well, we have gone into Paul Lehmann's papers and found a plastic file that says Dietrich's journal. The problem is, there is nothing in it. So there are probably still some missing links in Dietrich's connections and even motivations. And then Dietrich and his death. I have to say, as a liturgist, there is something very compelling about someone who will die for any cause whatever. Read your daily newspapers about Palestine and Israel. Who will die for something? Because I am a liturgist, I always notice dates. And of course, dates on the Christian calendar are somewhat elusive because of the shifty character of Easter. Bonhoeffer was put to death on the Monday after Low Sunday being the Sunday after Easter. Now, in 1945, that was April 9th. In 2001, that is April the 23rd, namely today, the Monday after Low Sunday. So in a sense, in terms of the Christian calendar, we are here the same day as was his death, which, as he said, was not the end, but the beginning. It is not just a political story that we are engaging in, and not just an ecclesiastical one, but an intensely personal one of which all politics and ecclesiology is made.
On the Political Historical Panel, the first presentation was given by Professor Jeffrey Hill, Professor of Literature and Religion at Boston University. Professor Hill.
I want to begin by quoting from Bonhoeffer's book, Akt und Sein, Act and Being, the dissertation which qualified him for the post of university lecturer. He writes, through the act of knowing, the known comes into the power of the eye. It can be arranged within the system of general knowledge. The goal of cognition is to close this system. Once it succeeds, the eye has become master of the world. For that reason alone, revelation is inimical to the system, for God is the master of the world. In the light of that comment by Bonhoeffer, I want to enter a word of warning about the film we saw this morning. Bonhoeffer did not die to the mellifluous sound of Lutheran chorales. He died alone and in ugliness. A film is an act of cognition. It is an attempt to close the system. Now, the system of general knowledge through which the eye seeks mastery is at one level, you may say, as innocuous as it appears. It's an act in which all must engage if they aspire to grasp their place in the world. And yet within the German political ethical system, 2 years before the National Socialists were elected into power in 1933, the demonic eye was already exuding its virulent power. It's there in the title of Hitler's book, Mein Kampf. And once this dimension of the cognitive eye is faced, it can be shown to be inevitable that the mind of the man who writes Akt und Sein will be inimical to, will be in eternal conflict with, the system developed by the mind of Mein Kampf. It's important that we recognize at how early a stage in the development of Bonhoeffer's thinking, the ground of the opposition to Nazism, which would bring him to his death in 1945, was being laid. It's also important that we realize the special characteristic of his resistant mind and sensibility. He was born into the upper professional class of parents who each traced their descent from men who had suffered for their political principles. Dietrich's paternal grandfather had been imprisoned in 1825 for expressing what had been called subversive liberal views. I stress Bonhoeffer's impeccable hereditary liberal credentials in order to emphasize that he is in no sense a simple offspring of that tradition. In more ways than one, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's sensibility was that of a radical conservative, if that is, it is a conservative characteristic to affirm the hierarchies. I would say that he believed in a natural aristocracy of the spirit. I can see no other way in which to read the section, The Sense of Quality, in Letters and Papers from Prison, where he writes, "Unless we have the courage to fight for a revival of wholesome reserve between man and man, we shall perish in an anarchy of human values. In other times, it may have been the business of Christianity to champion the equality of men. Its business today will be to defend passionately human dignity and reserve. The cheap insinuation that our attitude is antisocial, we shall simply have to put up with. They are the invariable protests of the rabble against decency and order." Now, the German phrase, die Pöbelherrschaft, means mob rule, and it's possible to see how Bonhoeffer's form of radical conservative self-discipline would take its stand against the hideous travesties of discipline inaugurated by the National Socialists. The conflict in which my limited comprehension understands Bonhoeffer to be engaged is that which takes place at once eternally and presently between the claims of the absolute and the extortions of spiritual and political absolutism. In chapter 6 of his great work, Ethics, Bonhoeffer writes, "The origin of action which accords with reality is not the pseudo-Lutheran Christ, who exists solely for the purpose of sanctioning the facts as they are, nor the Christ of radical enthusiasm, whose function is to bless every revolution, but is the incarnate God Jesus, who has accepted man and who has loved, condemned, and reconciled man, and with him the world." Two observations seem to me to be necessary here. First, that the radical misappropriation of Bonhoeffer's life and teaching by some British and American progressive theologians in the 1960s appears to be presciently understood in this passage from the Ethics. Bonhoeffer's phrase, which the English translation renders as the Christ of radical enthusiasm, is der radikal schwärmerische Christus, which, though I'm no Germanist, as will be obvious to you, strikes me as conveying more contempt than is indicated by the translation. We have to separate the Bonhoeffer legacy from the Bonhoeffer cult, much of which, I would hazard, is no better than romantische Schwärmerei, dedicated, as Bonhoeffer would say, to sanctioning the facts as they are. Sanctioning the facts as they are is not the same as facing the bitter fact. Bonhoeffer's position at that time was a peculiar one. It was peculiar in the sense that not only was he estranged from the pseudo-Lutheran state organization, the German Christians, he was also at odds, as the film showed us, with the strategic and tactical ambivalences of the Confessing Church, and was also a sense in which, for a relatively short period, in the spring of 1933, he was estranged from himself. This self-estrangement was made evident in two episodes which came virtually together in April 1933. In an article responding to the National Socialist boycott of Jewish businesses, he stated with some vehemence, "Here where Jew and German stand together under God's word is the church. Here it is proven whether or not the church is still the church." In that same month of April 1933, the father of Dietrich's Jewish brother-in-law, Gerhard Leibholz, died. The family, Gerhard was married to Dietrich's twin sister, Sabina, asked Dietrich to conduct the funeral service, but he declined to do so, having accepted the advice of his ecclesiastical superior that to conduct a funeral service for a Jew would not, in the circumstances of April 1933, be prudent. I take this episode directly from Bethge, who also prints part of the stricken letter that Bonhoeffer sent his brother-in-law 7 months later. I am tormented by the thought that I didn't do as you asked me at the time. It preys on my mind, because it's the kind of thing one can never make up for. Now, I read the clarion call, the message writ large in letters of blood on the posters which summoned us to this symposium. At the center of the firestorm of the Holocaust, Dietrich Bonhoeffer confronted the evils of the Third Reich and courageously opposed the godless face of Nazism. His theological and political resistance and condemnation of anti-Semitism cost him his life and established his place as a modern Christian martyr. I put this harangue alongside Bonhoeffer's words of contrition in his letter to his Jewish brother-in-law. I can't think what made me behave as I did. How could I have been so much afraid at the time? In these words, I recognize not the poster puppet of our state of the game, Romantische Schwärmerei, but the active mind and spirit of the man who went to his death at Flossenbürg extermination camp 12 years later, brave and composed, in the words of a hostile witness, an SS camp doctor, who added, "I have hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God."
Professor Jeffrey Hill. Following Professor Hill's remarks, the panel heard from Professor of History Dietrich Orloff of Boston University. Professor Orloff.
What I'd like to do is to put Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the somewhat larger context of the German resistance movement and its problems. And in doing that, I want to touch on four topics, and I do mean touch. First, a little on the historiography of the German resistance. Then some comments on why the German resistance failed. Thirdly, why religion loomed so large in the deliberations and discussions of the resistance leaders. And finally, something on Bonhoeffer's legacy for the post-1945 German Protestant churches and German Protestantism in general. Let me begin with the historiography. Generally speaking, historians have not been very kind to the German resistance, perhaps because the initial attempt to describe and analyze the resistance, which was by Hans Rotfels, who was one of the Jewish historians who had left Germany and then came back very quickly after the war and wrote a relatively short history of the resistance, which he gave the subtitle Eine Würdigung, an appreciation, and I'm afraid that's what it was. It was really an attempt to lift the resistance up as a political and moral model and to set them something of a monument. It didn't take very long for the revisionists to come along, who in a series of articles and books looked more or less at the black spots and warts of the resistance leaders and discovered that in many of their ideas and in many of their attitudes, they really were not very suitable models for the post-Nazi future of Germany. Then in the 1970s and 1980s, in an attempt to put the pendulum back again, particularly Peter Hoffmann wrote a series of books in which he dealt primarily with the military resistance and particularly with Klaus von Stauffenberg, who is, of course, who was the man who placed the bomb next to Hitler in the failed attempt to assassinate Hitler. Hoffmann tried to show the moral concerns and the great physical courage of the resistance leaders. Most recently, Theodor Hamerow, an American historian again, has sort of put the pendulum back and thinks that there is far more to criticize about the German resistance than there is to praise. Now, why the controversy? Most important, of course, they failed. Here were a group of men, mostly men at least, who set out to destroy an evil regime. And in the final analysis, of course, they didn't destroy the regime. That was done by the Allied armies. Now, why did they fail? Or rather, what is the dimension of their failure? And here, particularly the critics again, have come up with both a quantitative and a qualitative failure. The quantitative failure boils down to there just weren't very many resistors. In terms of just plain numbers, it is not all that many that were active in the German resistance. This is equally true, by the way, of the other European powers, countries. But even so, we come up at a maximum of roughly 10,000 people who were at least punished by the Nazis in some way or other between 1933 and 1945. And that, percentage-wise, of course, is not all that much out of a population of roughly 65 million. Now, their qualitative failure, partly they weren't very good at a conspiracy, despite the fact that many of these people were staff officers. Generally speaking, they were about one step ahead of the Gestapo. There is also the problem of compartmentalization. Conservatives were really not very concerned when the Nazis rounded up communists and social democrats in 1933. Some Catholic clergy protested vigorously the euthanasia, quote-unquote, measures, that is to say the killing of the mentally ill, by the Nazis, but they didn't have very much to say about the Nuremberg Laws of 1935. And then, finally, the ideological and political shortcomings. The resistors, virtually all of the resistance leaders, wrote a great deal, and they talked even more. Far too much, by the way, than was good for them. These were people who were doing a conspiracy, after all. You know, they made the job of the Gestapo very easy for them. But aside from that, when we look at their ideas, and again, I'm citing the critics here, there are a lot of shortcomings. Many of them either rejected political democracy or at least were very skeptical about it. They talked a lot about the unschooled masses that allowed Hitler to come to power. I mean, many of them really wanted some sort of authoritarian or pseudo-authoritarian system. Some of them spoke about the civilizing mission which the Germans would have to do in Poland. The Holocaust was not really their priority concern. So there is something to the slightly, no more than slightly, cynical conclusion that the best thing the German resistance did, or at least the leaders did, was to die, because that allowed the post-war, particularly West Germany, to have a ready group of martyrs for whom to name streets and schools without having to worry about the ideas that they were also carrying with them, and not unimportant by any means, without having a new stab in the back legend. That undoubtedly would have come up if they had succeeded. You know, would Germany have not won the war if it hadn't been for the assassination of Hitler? Now, there is, however, and that brings me to my third point, one area in which the German resistance is very unique, and that is on their concern with discussions of writing about the role of religion in society, and particularly in the post-Nazi society. If you look at other European resistance movements, they're much more concerned about national questions, political questions, not religion, by and large. Now, there are a number of reasons why they were so concerned about religion. One is, and this has a long tradition, secularization. In other words, that because the churches were no longer a real influence within the society, it allowed essentially a-religious, anti-religious movements like the Nazis to come to power, or at least to rise. Secondly, the traditional accommodationist stance of particularly the German Protestant churches. The silent dog syndrome, in other words, not barking when you see evil coming, the union of throne and altar. The point is that traditionally the German Protestant churches identified with the state, identified with the nation. Thirdly, only the German resistance is really confronted with an alternative religion in Nazism. And the Nazis are very, very clear about this, by the way. There is a comment by Roland Freisler. Roland Freisler was that infamous chief of the People's Court that tried Bonhoeffer and some of the other resistors. And at one point during the proceedings said that he and the conspirators really had something in common, which was, quote, we both demand total commitment from a human being. And this was true. And so it is that which the German resistors were against. And therefore, they were so concerned and so determined to put religion in place of what was really an anti-religion. And finally, for practical purposes, only the German resistors are concerned or are confronted with the problem of tyrannicide, which is to say, should Hitler be killed or should he not be killed? Bonhoeffer eventually answered yes. It was correct. It was ethical to kill Hitler. Some of the other resistors could not bring themselves to this step. And even those that did, like Bonhoeffer, really, you know, it was a long path from an essentially pacifist stand to come to this. And finally, let me conclude with a few words about Bonhoeffer's legacy for the post-1945 German churches. This may have come originally, but certainly from Karl Barth, but certainly Bonhoeffer emphasized it and was more eloquent about it. And that is that the churches have a constant duty to judge all aspects of human life, including themselves, using the unshakable precepts of Christian ethics. This is a total, and it was meant to be, a total break with the long-established, particularly Lutheran concept of the union of throne and altar, which eventually became throne and nation. All the Nazis did was to, instead of having throne and nation, or state and nation, the Nazis simply made the nation into the throne, or into God, eventually. That turnaround came very quickly. Even in 1945, I think it's July, there's a so-called Stuttgart Confession, in which the Protestant churches openly acknowledge their guilt in allowing the Nazis to come to power and in failing to resist the Nazis. Secondly, ecumenicalism. The German churches, by and large, before 1945, were not particularly active in the ecumenical movement. Bonhoeffer, of course, was, and that, I think, laid the groundwork for the denationalizing of the German churches after 1945. And finally, I'd like to stress the concept, which again, I think, comes out of Bonhoeffer, that public figures have a duty to speak out on questions of morality and ethics. So I would argue, then, that Bonhoeffer, aside from his theological contributions, had a major role in establishing the new civic society that fortunately emerged after 1945. Thank you.
Professor Dietrich Orloff. Following Dr. Orloff's presentation, comments from the Chancellor of Boston University, Dr. John Silver. Dr. Silver.
Dietrich Bonhoeffer, as has been said, we are dealing with a saint. We're not dealing with a person who is likely to be emulated by very many people. Those who decide to emulate him probably will be in line for sainthood themselves. As a pacifist, of course, he was in a position that was his own sincere view, but not a deeply thought out one, because the pacifist is the ally of the stronger side, as he came to see himself when he finally reached the decision that tyrannicide was necessary. But in getting to that conclusion, he had a very long and difficult process of thought. One of the most important things he wrote was New Year's Reckoning of 1943. And in that, he said that we stand in a position at a time when there is no ground underfoot, when every alternative seems impossible. And he talked about the difficulty when evil masquerades as social justice, as charity, as historical necessity, all the things that the evil of the communist regime under Stalin and the Nazi regime under Hitler claimed as justifications for what they were doing. Social justice, historical necessity, and all those very good things. And when evil appears to be good, then it seems to undermine ethical concepts. But as Bonhoeffer argues, for Christians, it poses no problem at all. It's simply another recognition of the wickedness of evil. He talks about the indefensibility of various approaches that have been offered in the history of the human race. Reasonable men will never succeed. They lack the realism to recognize that other people are unreasonable. And when they find out that they are unreasonable, they then shift to the sidelines and step aside. The moral fanatic may be righteous indeed, absolutely clear about his goals, but there's no compromise there, and like a bull, he's distracted by the cape, and he is killed by more clever enemies. The man of conscience has nothing to guide him but his own conscience, and the alternatives that are presented are such that he can't maintain his course. And then he talks about the way of duty. Here, it seems to me, he says, a person of duty will never venture out on his own responsibility. That I don't quite understand, because I think that an analysis of duty in Immanuel Kant would not result in that conclusion. On the other hand, when he comes to the man of freedom, he says, The man of freedom who expresses himself is willing to sacrifice principle for useful compromise or barren wisdom for fruitful radicalization. He assents to what is bad in order to avoid what is worse. But he overlooks that what he is trying to avoid might be better than what is the result of his compromise. Now, here he is rejecting compromise out of hand. And yet, I think there are times in his life, critical times in his life, in which he exercises compromise. And does he really want to condemn a Schindler who compromised furiously? And Schindler managed to save about 600 people. But he bribed, he cheated, he did all kinds of things in violation of the law, in violation of also morality. And I suppose that Schindler would have probably said it was also an exercise of duty. So where does Bonhoeffer come off with regard to Schindler? Private virtuousness, he says, leaves you nowhere. You want to be virtuous in your garden, like a character out of Voltaire? That's the hypocrisy of the Pharisees. Who stands fast? The only one who stands fast, according to Bonhoeffer, are the Christians, those who are obedient to God. But how do you know who's obedient to God? It seems to me there we are on the same shaky ground that we are with regard to conscience, because Bishop Delius, all the other churchmen, I'm sure thought that they were being steadfast to God. And we do have the powerful influence of Martin Luther, who condemned the peasants' revolt and who asserted the authority of obedience. That authority of obedience was so powerful that even Immanuel Kant was absolutely opposed to revolution and to the assault against the state, because he thought, since the state is the condition of our having a moral system, to assert an overthrow of the state or to advocate an overthrow of the state was to throw morality to the winds. All of this makes it very difficult to know where we stand. And I wonder whether Bonhoeffer was a saint because he was a Christian, or because whether he was a saint who happened to be a Christian. I would certainly agree that philosophers don't necessarily withstand this kind of test, but a Socrates does, an Epictetus does. Not all people who are religious stand the test, but every now and then one comes along who does. And I wonder whether it is perhaps to be understood in terms of some kind of revelation that these persons have, which is inimical to the system. One thing I think we can learn from Bonhoeffer with regard to today is, don't make the mistake of thinking you can domesticate Bonhoeffer, particularly the clergy and members of religious organizations. If you read his wedding sermon sent from prison to Eberhard Bethge and his niece Renata, he clearly outlines what it means to be married before God and the obligations of the man and the woman. The woman's rule is to serve her husband and create a little kingdom, an ideal kingdom in which children can be nurtured. These two are to see their obligation to one another under the eyes of God, and an obligation that can never be broken, a marriage that can never be resolved. And if one believes that Bonhoeffer would stand idly by with the alterations of the morality that we have seen in the last 50 years, where television becomes the arbiter of what's proper, where the Gay and Lesbian Alliance have more power than most persons seem able to resist, when abortion, those who advocate abortion on demand and the most casual circumstances, when there's so many people who are engaged in careers that they have no time for the children, then one sees the radical nature of what Bonhoeffer is talking about. This is a man who takes the Sermon on the Mount seriously. This is a man who takes seriously the strong teachings of Jesus, and is a person whose orientation toward this life bears a relationship to another life to come. And he judges this life in terms of it, so he never takes as seriously the demands and the ambitions of this world as other people do. He, it seems to me, illustrates a point that William James tried to make but never effectively illustrated when he talked about the will to believe, that by believing in God, he ends up with a greater dignity and a greater capacity for full living than he would have without it, and that persons who marry under a conception of God have a capacity to recognize the sanctity of their children in a way that those who simply have the child an accidental effect of a casual love affair would never have. He shows the way in which belief in something transcendent can add a dimension to life that otherwise is not there.
Dr. John Silber, Chancellor of Boston University. The concluding speaker on the panel on the political and historical Bonhoeffer was Ambassador Charles Stith, author of Political Religion.
I want to limit the scope of my remarks to the significance of Bonhoeffer's theology for the civil rights and post-civil rights eras. I focused on this area for three reasons. One, prior to becoming the U.S. ambassador to Tanzania, I considered myself to be a political preacher. And as such, I saw myself as one who was both a product of, as well as a participant in, the civil rights movement. And it was within that context that I've come to understand the requirements of faithful discipleship, or to use Bonhoeffer's language, the cost of discipleship. Secondly, I decided I'd focus on this area in terms of the significance of Bonhoeffer's theology for the civil rights movement et al., because his presence is clearly reflected, I think, in the theological underpinnings of the movement, and it's also reflected in my own theology. And thirdly, though Dr. Silber hit on some of this in his remarks, I also think that Bonhoeffer has something to say for the church in the present age. One notion in particular in which Bonhoeffer's influence, I think, was felt within the civil rights movement is his condemnation of the church's sin in its desire for cheap grace. Authentic Christianity for Bonhoeffer is more than the church fulfilling its sacerdotal function. It is the church being faithful to its sacrificial requirements. Personal salvation is impossible without acts that have implications politically in terms of the redemption of broader society. Personal repentance and political repentance operate or must operate simultaneously. In the civil rights movement, you see this imprint of Bonhoeffer's coming through, again, as I said, in this notion of the cheap grace. When you look at Martin Luther King Jr., his writings, in his words, this language of Bonhoeffer comes through, the sentiment of Bonhoeffer in this regard comes through time and time again, whether it is in the sentiments captured in his now famous letter from the Birmingham jail, when he challenges the established church to be responsive and responsible in the moment, or in his sermons that he offered from such pulpits as the Riverside Church to the Missionary Baptist Church, a Pentecostal church, and a sundry of other communities around the country. Now, the importance of Bonhoeffer's exposure, or rather, should I say, Martin's exposure to Bonhoeffer as they struggled with what the church was called to be in the civil rights era, is that this matter of cheap grace was a question of urgent significance. Not just in the white churches to whom Martin addressed the letter to the letter from Birmingham jail, but it was also an urgent question for the black church as well. While we talk nostalgically about the civil rights movement and the fact that the zeitgeist of that era seemed to have caught everyone up in its grasp, the reality was that everybody wasn't there. We'd often joke that if everybody who said they marched with Martin did, in fact, march with him, we would have won the civil rights movement a long, long, long time ago. And if those of you who are students of the King's personal history, you'd also appreciate that when he went to Dexter Avenue Baptist Church, he went to that church as a black PhD to pastor a silk stocking congregation. And the expectation was that because he came on with a PhD from Boston University, he would be expected to engage in a very quiet pastorate. So this question of cheap grace for the church in the civil rights era was a very important question because of the political implications. For my generation, it was important, this matter of cheap grace, but for a slightly different reason. For us, whether the church ought to be political or not was not the issue. For us, it was rather what kind of political activity. You know, if we had any problem at all when I was in seminary, it was the fact that everybody wanted to be the next Martin Luther King Jr. For us, cheap grace, as Bonhoeffer articulated it, was both a summary statement and a summary judgment in terms of the church's mission. The church must act politically! Exclamation point. The dilemma, though, that Bonhoeffer presented in my era was an interesting one. On the one hand, there were those who were proponents of black power and black theology, like Jim Cone, Albert Klieg, who articulated that the church needed to be an agent of liberation by any means necessary. For them, Bonhoeffer spoke to their side of the argument. For others, like M.J. Jones or J.D. Otis Roberts, who saw themselves as theologians of the nonviolent tradition of the civil rights movement, they felt that Bonhoeffer spoke for them in terms of his advocacy for the church in action and the need for costly grace. I confess that we did not resolve that dilemma then, and I would suggest that quite possibly it isn't important to resolve it right now or right here. The point is that the church is called to act politically, and that action is not to be defined, the church should not define itself, rather, vis-a-vis any particular movement. But the challenge is to be faithful in the moment. This I take as a segue to my third and final point, and that is focusing on what Bonhoeffer has to say to the church and popular Christianity today. When we survey popular Christianity, and particularly some of our so-called mega churches, what we hear from the pulpits might be categorized as self-help psychobabble using theological language. If the subject of cheap grace comes up at all, it refers to people using the services and ministries of the church without tithing. The church has an obligation, obviously, profoundly beyond that. The notion of the servant church clearly must be and needs to be rediscovered. This past weekend, a very dear and longtime friend of mine, who is a senior level executive at a Fortune 500 company based in Cincinnati, Ohio, visited with me. When we got together, our attention turned to circumstances in Cincinnati. And as we talked about the sense of anger and angst that the black community and alienation that the black community in Cincinnati felt and feels, which gave rise, really, that's the thing that gave rise to this, the riots or rebellions, depending upon your particular perspective. As we talked about the history of race relations in the city of Cincinnati, the history of race relations in our country, and the different strategies that have been employed to try to salve the wounds of race, and conflict, as we looked at other parts of the country, Boston being one place, in terms of examples, a signpost to which the people of Cincinnati might look to find their way out of this morass, our conversation finally concluded focusing on the work of the church. that certainly a new covenant needs to be struck in Cincinnati. That's the work of the church. Certainly there needs to be new principles around which community can be refashioned and reformed. That is the work of the church. And there are those who feel totally disenfranchised, who cry out for justice. Being their advocates is certainly the work of the church. It's the church appreciating the cost of discipleship. That's why Bonhoeffer's legacy lives, and so should it be.
Ambassador and Minister Charles Stiff. You've been listening to the first of two programs drawn from a symposium on Dietrich Bonhoeffer, held at Boston University, entitled Faith and Resistance, the Struggle of a German Theologian Against Nazi Terror. The presentations heard tonight, delivered by the panel on Bonhoeffer's political and historical impact, were edited to meet time constraints. The speakers were Jeffrey Hill, Professor of Religion and Literature at Boston University, Professor of History also at Boston University, Dietrich Orloff, Dr. John Silber, Chancellor of Boston University, and Ambassador Charles Stiff. Following their formal presentations, the panel held a discussion of the issues they'd raised and also answered questions from the audience. The discussion was moderated by Boston journalist Christopher Lydon. Join us again next week when Boston University's World of Ideas will present Part 2 of Faith and Resistance, the Theological and Educational Impact of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Work and Ideas. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Bob Zalisk and Vince Fairchild. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Special thanks to Bill Galuli. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.